The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individuals participating in the podcast. This podcast also contains subject matter which may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
But if they really aim their bullets at Tony Fauci, well, people could recognize there's a person there, there's a face, there's a vice you can recognize.
On November 28th, 2021, Dr. Anthony Fauci was interviewed by CBS News.
So it's easy to criticize, but they're really criticizing science because I represent science.
He had amassed an influential following, plenty of defenders and also deniers.
Dr. Fauci, thank you for doing all you can to keep America healthy.
I mean, look at all these celebrities.
You are America's scientist.
They worship this guy.
This wasn't something I found remotely suspicious back in 2020. I mean, it felt natural to have a singular expert voice, a leader, guide us through a pandemic. But in the doc, Jenner first takes a step back and asks, was that normal? And once he poses that question, it's kind of hard to unthink. Shoutouts from Jimmy Kimmel.
Thank you for leading us, Dr. Fauci. We greatly
Julia Roberts.
Really like my personal hero right now.
Brad Pitt.
Thank you for your calm, clarity.
Elton John.
People on this planet who have dedicated themselves to a lifetime of service to save millions of lives like Dr. Fauci.
Look, we were all enduring a crisis. And I don't blame any celebrity for their support. It's likely all from a genuine place, saving lives.
We are all so grateful for your leadership.
Prior to COVID-19, one of the most impactful moments in American and global history that I remember was 9/11. And something similar occurred there. Celebrities united to honor the heroes and raise funds. It was a powerful testament to resilience and compassion. But this collective support, while heartfelt, also came with a side effect, sometimes distracting the public from deeper issues, like the government's decision in the aftermath, waging war with the wrong country. So, with all this support for Fauci and the pandemic response, what else, if anything, was happening just out of sight? From Tenderfoot TV, I'm Payne Lindsay, and this is Leaked. Episode 2, Our Gain or Our Loss.
Okay, I like the background, okay? Yeah. What are you going to sneak in the background?
Nothing.
You got a green screen back there or something?
No green screen.
You're going to make me look like I'm in a jail or prison? Is that what this is?
No, not at all, no. It's more kind of a post-apocalyptic world.
Like I mentioned in the last episode, Jenner first gave me access to everything he had. Hours of interviews, piles of documents. It was a lot to take in. But one thing stood out from the moment I watched the doc. The interview of Dr. Robert Redfield, former director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
I was supposed to do the original Barbara Walters interview back in 83, where we were trying to teach the American public not to be afraid about AIDS.
But the Army blocked my appearance.
This Redfield interview is a rare gem. Redfield doesn't do these often, only accepting requests from the big three-letter networks, or Congress. So getting my hands on the raw tape felt like stepping behind the curtain. This guy, Dr. Robert Redfield, had a whole bunch to say, but it got drowned out by another voice.
Thank you very much, Dr. Birx, Mr. President, Mr. Vice President. As I've mentioned several times in our briefings, the virus, if left to its own devices, will do that.
In 2020, Dr. Anthony Fauci appeared almost every day at the White House podium, as well as on ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, all of them. He was a guest on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel, featured across the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, even landed on the cover of Time Magazine for its annual list of 100 most influential people. He was a household name. And Redfield, not so much. Honestly, before watching Thank You, Dr. Fauci, I'd never even heard of Dr. Redfield. So who is he exactly? And how and why did he end up in the shadows during a career-defining crisis?
following medical school, I had an assignment at Walter Reed in the Department of Viral Diseases.
Dr. Redfield was one of the first to flag HIV transmission beyond the gay community. A big move back then.
I was able to do some work that I was able to show, contrary to popular opinion at the time by the Public Health Service, that about 90% of people were getting sicker over time. So this was dominantly a disease that was going to progress to death in a majority of people that were infected. It wasn't met with a lot of enthusiasm. I remember I was booed off the stage in Atlanta when I presented this paper because people didn't like the conclusions.
But Redfield is no stranger to controversy. In the 90s, accusations were thrown around that he overstated HIV vaccine data, and an army investigation followed. Ultimately, no charges, but his reputation took a hit. Later in 2018, when he became the CDC director, he was backed by conservative and evangelical circles. My thing is, when it comes to studying and responding to a global pandemic, the more experts, the better, right? To get to the truth, it's good to consider more than one opinion.
No matter what your prior thoughts were, everybody agrees with that. There are no lab leaks that have led to pandemics.
Now, let's see what Redfield has to say.
COVID was immediately, in my view, probably the second most infectious virus in the history of mankind. And I think when the end of the day comes out, you'll see the bulk of the evidence is, unfortunately, that this virus was a consequence of science, not a consequence of nature. And this is why I've been a big advocate of calling on Congress to do a moratorium on gain-of-function research.
Gain-of-function. What is it?
It's almost science with no restraints.
At its simplest, it's changing a virus, sometimes to make it stronger.
So many of us can immediately, from a sort of sci-fi standpoint, imagine what the costs and the fears associated with these experiments are.
In 2016, professors at Penn State had their own debate about this, weighing the risk-reward for this type of research.
So the important question is, what are the potential benefits for these?
The rationale is pretty simple. If you can identify a specific part, or say a gene in an organism that is responsible for disease, then you actually have a target that you can aim for therapeutics.
Scientists use these experiments to understand how viruses work, testing how they spread, adapt, and react to different treatments. The idea boils down to this. The deadlier virus we create, the stronger the vaccine needs to be to fight it, so that when a pathogen mutates from a natural source, we're ready for it. However, this kind of research is relatively new.
I think one of the big issues that precipitated this discussion was 2 years ago when there were two different labs that genetically engineered the H5N1 influenza virus that killed most of the humans that were infected but never transmitted from human to humans, and then they ended.
These professors are discussing an incident from 2012, back when the term gain of function really first hit the public radar. Two research teams announced they'd engineered an avian flu virus to spread between ferrets, an animal model close to humans, and the reaction from the scientific community was intense.
And I think there were two scientific studies were embargoed for 6 months or so from being published because nobody knew the risks associated with this.
I think that example is really important because we as a scientific community don't know what we're doing.
At the end of the day, this isn't just about science. It's also about how far we're willing to go to push the limits. And in doing so, what might push back? Since the pandemic, talk around gain-of-function research has heated up in the scientific world. Some say it's essential, a safeguard against global catastrophe.
As you know, in science, we're doing gain-of-function experiments all the time.
This is Dr. Francis Collins on the Lex Fridman podcast, a physician geneticist and former director of the National Institutes of Health. Collins wasn't just any figure in science. He was the guy who oversaw U.S. research grants, meaning he had a major hand in deciding what studies got funded and which discoveries got prioritized.
We support a lot of cancer immunotherapy at NIH. right here in our clinical center. There are trials going on where people's immune cells are taken out of their body, treated with a genetic therapy that revs up their ability to discover the cancer, maybe even at stage four, and then give them back as those little ninja warriors go after the cancer. And it sometimes works dramatically. That's gain of function. So we got to be careful not to say, oh, gain of function is bad. Most of what we do in science that's good involves quite a bit of that. The kind of gain of function, which is now subject to very rigorous oversight, is when you are working with an established human pathogen and you are potentially enhancing its transmissibility or its virulence. So I will argue that the more you know about the coming enemy, the better chance you have to recognize when trouble is starting.
On the other side of the conversation, you've got voices like Dr. Patrick Flum, a top pulmonologist and respiratory specialist.
I have learned a lot in the last few weeks, and I don't know that I know what gain of function is anymore.
Dr. Flum shared his perspective during a debate at the 2023 World Health Week.
There is a long list of therapies that we have for the treatment of viruses, but most of these were not derived, these therapies were not derived from the benefit of gain-of-function research. And vaccine developers don't really think there's a need for gain-of-function research. Gain-of-function research is tended to focus on those experiments which are expected to increase the transmissibility and or the virulence of these pathogens. So the question then is, what are the chances that those genetic changes would happen in nature?
It's a powerful question. Are we engineering a humanity-ending weapon for a threat that might never arrive? Scary to think about, at least.
Doctors have a responsibility to do no harm, but Anthony Fauci was putting the life of everyone on the planet at risk without their consent.
In 2012, researchers altered avian flu so it could spread more easily among mammals. The scientific community split hard on whether that was a smart move or reckless.
Researchers took bird flu and manipulated it to make it easier to transmit between humans.
Two separate teams used gain of function to make bird flu airborne in mammals, a groundbreaking and deeply unsettling first. Both projects were funded through the NIH, the National Institute of Health. But one team's funding was openly tied to a key figure.
And representing the U.S. government and the funding agency for this research is Dr. Tony Fauci.
These studies ignited a firestorm, labeled as, quote, dual-use research of concern.
We recommended to the U.S. government that the papers be modified, the results and experimental details be redacted, so that somebody with malevolent intent could not exactly replicate the results.
Due to these papers, Anthony Fauci, alongside Ron Fouché, the lead scientist, faced some scrutiny during a biodefense conference in D.C.
We already did everything we can to protect the virus from getting out of our facilities, and I will leave it with that for now.
I think that what we need to make sure is that we don't mix apples and oranges.
Here's a clip from the doc of Jenner's reaction to that moment.
People have mixed opinions, but if it had leaked, the virus could have killed like 20 to 50% of the world's population. Fauci didn't apologize. Fauci celebrated it, and he actually wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that this was a flu risk worth taking.
Yeah, and let me just follow up. You know, any SARS, any number of viruses, it would be a horrible tragedy if they ever were to leak out, but we could contain them and it would not see a global pandemic.
Wait, what?
SARS, if they ever were to leak out, but we could contain them and it would not see a global pandemic.
Further, he knew. He knew this could happen, and it seems like it's happened a lot of times before.
If this were a criminal investigation, we'd probably look at pre-offensive behavior, as in what led up to this event. As an example, let's consider someone falls down the stairs. Before the fall, was their life normal? Or were there signs of trouble? Did they say anything strange? Have a falling out with someone? Was there an owl there? Just kidding. But seriously, we'd be looking for subtle clues to see if they hint at something bigger. If we use that lens for COVID, the picture does feel off. It starts in 2012, with Fauci and Fouché downplaying the risk of gain-of-function research. Then it jumps to 2014, with an Ebola outbreak in West Africa.
The outbreak in 2014 had never been seen in West Africa before. It's found in Zaire, which is 2,000 miles away.
A lab in Sierra Leone is suspected as the source. Then, after that outbreak, the U.S. places a 3-year moratorium on gain-of-function research. The following year, in 2015, China opens its first BSL-4 lab in Wuhan, the highest level of biosecurity you could have. Full lab suits, respirators, the real deal. According to David Asher, a former State Department member, he said,
in 2015, the Wuhan Institute of Virology has launched a global recruitment plan of principal investigators under the Outstanding Foreign Talents Program, quote unquote, of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And the NIH is actually helping match scientists to the Chinese program to recruit our most sensitive biologists.
One American scientist working in Wuhan says the CIA even contacted his boss there.
Why would the Chinese allow Americans, their enemy, into their bioweapons laboratory? The answer for me is simple. We traded the Chinese the most advanced biotechnology in the world for access to their bioweapons laboratory so we could collect intelligence on it.
By 2017, the U.S. lifted the ban on gain-of-function research. And we now know that grants signed by Dr. Fauci contributed funds to the Wuhan lab. For what exactly, we don't know. But back to our main question. Did we stumble into this pandemic? Or were we nudged? Was COVID engineered? Or was it natural? We can't visit the crime scene anymore. That moment's gone. But we still have the DNA and the forensics. And that's what Dr. Redfield starts to point out in detail.
This is where I come in at it as a clinical virologist who understands, I think, to a large degree, better than many, how viruses go from animals to humans. And when they go from animals to humans, it takes them a long time to learn how to replicate effectively in humans. For example, when you look at SARS when it came in 2003.
SARS is a deadly respiratory illness caused by a virus first identified in 2002.
SARS never learned how to go efficiently human to human to be a major threat. When MERS came in 2012 from a bat to a camel, and then from the camel to people who worked with camels. But it never learned how to efficiently go human to human. So again, 10 years later, there's less than 10,000 cases. But when COVID came, COVID immediately understood how to replicate effectively in humans. And that's why I was a high proponent of the hypothesis that yes, there's natural spillover that Tony and others promoted. But the other hypothesis is that this virus came out of a laboratory that was involved in gain-of-function research, intentionally trying to change the virus so it could be more efficiently transmitted to humans.
He breaks it down. First, he speculates why the Wuhan lab would even want to supercharge a coronavirus.
I believe that the lab was working to develop a vaccine vector that could be used to vaccinate the Chinese military and the Chinese people. They wanted that vector to have certain characteristics. One, it had to be highly infectious and transmissible by aerosol or droplets so that one didn't have to use needles to vaccinate people. You could vaccinate them by aerosol exposure.
What Redfield's suggesting is this. The Chinese might have been working on an airborne vaccine, but to create that, they'd first need an airborne virus, one that spreads fast. One like COVID.
That fear in cleaver site is not natural. It doesn't belong there. To me, it's a signature that was engineered to change the receptor binding so that this virus now become highly infectious for humans, which it did. It also has some changes in it that knock out the interferon response element, which means when you get this virus, you won't get sick. And it also has some changes related to the humoral immunity related to it, suggestive that it will be non-durable so that you could potentially use this vaccine vector over and over again.
He closely examined COVID sequence. Basically, COVID slips right past our immune defenses, letting it spread easily without setting off alarms in our system. I mean, that's how I felt when I got it. These details, discovered in the early days of COVID, didn't sit right with him. And so he made a call to his colleague.
So I called Tony to talk about my concern.
Tony being Anthony Fauci.
I talked to him aggressively about that I thought that he should lead an aggressive scientific transparent investigation into the two probable hypotheses, spillover and lab leak, that NIH should take the lead on that so we can get our hands about origin. I told him that I think the evidence of the papers that were published by the Wuhan lab, that this virus was way too infectious in humans right out of the gate. I felt strongly that it had been educated in the laboratory. Now, at that time, I didn't have the data that they were still funding the laboratory.
Like I mentioned earlier, the Wuhan lab received NIH grants signed by Fauci. But that wasn't information the science community or the rest of the world learned until after 2020.
I did have data that Tony had funded the laboratory because NAID was acknowledged on the paper in 2014 in funding that laboratory. And I said, we really have to get to the bottom of this because if this is a engineered virus with an ability to effectively replicate in humans.
The paper he mentioned details research tied to the Wuhan lab on modifying SARS-CoV viruses to help them bind to human receptors, the very feature that makes COVID-19 so contagious.
Or in the middle of February, President Trump made Vice President Pence in charge of it. I would interact with Fauci on the White House task force. We obviously disagreed on the potential of origin in those meetings where I expressed pretty aggressively that I thought this was most likely a consequence of gain-of-function research from the laboratory. Tony said it publicly many times that this was not consistent with a laboratory, that it came from nature. And that's sort of where the lines were drawn. And I didn't know this at the time because I didn't have the Freedom of Information Act and know about the February 1st phone calls.
The phone call he's referring to is the private teleconference with the panel of 13 scientists we mentioned in episode 1.
But they organized those individuals on that call to discuss the potential origin. And I think a number of them originally thought objectively it probably was not from nature. But within 2 or 3 days of the call, they all agreed that it had to come from nature. I always ask why I wasn't included, and Fauci argues he didn't exclude me. I'm not saying he excluded me. I'm saying I wasn't included. He didn't include me. And I was told by some members of that group that the reason I wasn't included, that they had a decision that they were going to come out with a single consensus point of view that everyone had to agree with, and that it was clear that I wasn't going to be capable of that.
Throughout this whole process, I kept noticing Fauci and Redfield looked at similar information and came to different early instincts. It doesn't mean one was right or wrong. It means people interpret uncertainty very differently, especially in a crisis.
So, I mean, I think the evidence is so clear, particularly in the last 3 to 4 years, and there's no new evidence that this virus came as a spillover event.
Redfield strongly believes that certain types of high-risk research need tighter oversight. Other scientists say that same research helps prevent outbreaks. Again, two things can be true at the same time, and that tension is important.
We now know that the epidemic in Wuhan probably started in August, September, October. It didn't start at the marketplace. I mean, that's all a roost. So it was a consequence of biomedical research that was probably designed to do something good. But unfortunately, when you're working with respiratory viruses and you're not doing them in proper containment, you're going to end up with lab leaks.
Gain-of-function research is fast-tracking virus evolution to better understand these violent organisms and how to fight them. But a single accident, a failed ventilation system, a suit not fully decontaminated, one tiny human error, and an invisible nano-sized cell escapes a bio lab. It could mean disaster on a global scale. So should we even be conducting this kind of research?
I'm of the point of view that we need to have a broader debate that needs to include the civilian community to determine, is it necessary for us to do this research? Instead, it's a group of scientists. And I'll guarantee you that most of the labs that are doing gain-of-function research right now are not following containment. So this is a big deal, and we shouldn't be in this space. I'm still not convinced that there's value. We don't need the head start that we might have needed 3 decades ago. We don't have the proper biocontainment in these labs. People know that I'm of the view, and one of the reasons I'm really focused on this biosecurity, I'm of the view that the great pandemic is coming. I consider the COVID pandemic really a minor pandemic.
But I am not, as of today, confident that a better course was then open.
We have control over development of nuclear weapons, all right? We don't say anybody can develop nuclear weapons and do what they want. We need the same regulations over science that could pose biological threats.
Toward the end of his interview, Redfield compares high-risk biological research to nuclear technology. A dramatic analogy, sure, but he was speaking from concern, not theatrics. And whether you agree with him or not, the concern in itself is very real.
The thing that I'll probably continue to do as aggressively as I can is trying to convince the American people and our country that we need a proportional investment to the threat for biosecurity. And to me, that means building sort of a parallel biodefense strategy modeled off the Defense Department that really has the capacity to detect, identify, and respond to novel pathogens.
When you play a meaningful part in bringing about the death of over 100,000 people, and you naturally don't think of that as with ease.
I rewatched Oppenheimer the other day, and I watched to the end of it pretty carefully as he was struggling with the reality of what he created. You know, his scientific success created a weapon that killed tens of thousands of people, but more importantly, created an industry of weapons that could destroy the world. I think gain-of-function research is what I consider the scientific arrogance to think that we can control science for the benefit of man and there's no downside. I'm arguing there's a big downside, and we need to wake up to it sooner than later.
When I investigate missing persons cases, I always look at who shaped the early story and how. What got amplified? What got overlooked? What got simplified? It's the same approach here. I'm not here to say where COVID came from, because I don't know. I'm not here to validate or debunk anyone's theory. I want to understand why the early narrative feels so incomplete. How different experts interpreted the same situation so differently. And why this topic is still so hard to talk about without someone jumping to conclusions. And yes, I'm using Jenner's documentary as one of my starting points. Because clearly, he spent more time on this than I have. But that doesn't mean I'm agreeing with every point he makes. It simply means that some of what he found made me want to look closer myself. That's the lane I'm in. The middle. The calm lane. The let's actually try to understand this lane.
A Republican congressman from New Jersey wants the Pentagon to reveal whether it experimented on ticks with the goal of turning them into weapons and whether this led to the spread of Lyme disease in the U.S.
And next time on Leaked, we keep following that thread very carefully to see what else this early story can tell us.
Real scare playing out in Atlanta tonight. The CDC asking how could this happen? One of their own workers making a huge and dangerous mistake, potentially exposing his coworkers to live anthrax.
Thanks for listening to Leaked, a podcast inspired by the documentary Thank You, Dr. Fauci. If you want to see the full story, the interviews, the evidence, and more, check out the documentary streaming now on Angel Studios. Visit angel.com. Leaked is a production of Tenderfoot Labs, produced in partnership with Insight Studios, Angel Studios, and Bombadil Productions. Producers on behalf of Insight Studios are Jenna First, Louis Fenton, Scott St. John, and Arnold Rifkin. Executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot Labs are Donald Albright, Payne Lindsay, and Alex Vespestead. Tenderfoot Labs' lead producer is Tristan Bankston. Editing by Liam Luxon. Associate editors are Miles Clark and Cameron Taggy. Coordinating producers are John Street and Jordan Foxworthy. Artwork by Where Eagles Dare. Music by Danielle First, Kyrie Mateen, and Jay Ragsdale. Mixed by Dayton Cole. For more podcasts like Leaked, search Tenderfoot TV on your favorite podcast app or visit us at tenderfoot.tv. Thanks for listening.